Welcome.
Oh, we're starting early today.
Today we have the May 22nd edition of Senate Revenue.
You can keep trying, but it's always 8:30.
I know.
Yeah.
The committee by acclamation is recessed at 10 yet again.
I'll fix the clock. I've done it before.
6 o'clock. We're going to begin with House Bill 2306.
The battery's
up. We have this morning with us, for the honor of the presence of the House Revenue Chair, Ms. Jolene Shetterly. We'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2206 and invite
the
Chair to give us his wisdom on this bill.
Well, good morning. Members of the committee, Representative Lane Shetterly, State District, House District 34. I am here not so much on the bill, except to tell you it must be a great bill. It came through our committee, and there's a lot of good things, so I'm sure it's a great bill, Measure 50 cleanup. I'm here actually on the Dash 1 amendments that I am proposing to you for your consideration, and I hope adopt this morning. You may have received the memo from me yesterday. I tried to get it to all of your offices yesterday. This is a very, very modest expansion of the tax credit for rural medical providers. I was sitting in traffic. It took me an hour to get home last night on Highway 22 because of an automobile accident on the road, thinking about this amendment that I was proposing and how glad I am for the times that we get traffic balled up between Dallas and Salem, that I don't depend on getting to the emergency room at Salem Hospital. Of course, once you get there, it's about a six-hour wait, unless you're first in line with a gunshot wound. The point about that is the critical nature of the hospital that serves Dallas and how important that is as part of the regional health care that is provided here in the Valley. It provides a necessary level of medical service to people in Dallas, and by the same token, it relieves a demand on Salem Hospital that is already operating at above capacity in terms of their ability to provide the level of services that is demanded of that hospital. At the same time, we are experiencing in Dallas a challenge that is common among a lot of rural communities, and that is recruitment and retention of medical providers. And so I'm asking you for this amendment, the Dash 1 amendments, that have the effect of extending the income tax credit to rural medical providers to practitioners. And the way this bill is drafted, it applies, I'll tell you, to one hospital in Dallas and a hospital in Columbia County that's currently closed but is being considered for reopening. And this bill would help create the incentive to recruit doctors to that community as well. So it's very narrow. I wanted to keep the revenue impact as minimal as possible, and we have done that. I'm just trying to think if there's anything else that you need to know about that. It's over the $5,000 credit for rural medical providers, and I guess what I would say is that you have a community like Dallas and up in Columbia County that depends on a local hospital, but when you are in such close proximity to the major metropolitan area of which you are a part, and by reason of that disqualified under current law for the medical rural medical care tax credit, it makes it difficult to bring those doctors across the river and over the fields and into that smaller community. As long as they're in the area, it is real tempting to chase the bright lights of the bigger community and the bigger hospital. So I'm asking you for your indulgence with this bill. Again, it's very narrow, but it's also very important to me. I will say that I did work with the Office of Rural Health and the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems in drafting this language. To my knowledge, there is no opposition to this. It's just such a small little thing. And it does not do violence to the policy of the credit that undergirds the provision of medical services to rural communities, and most importantly, keeping hospitals open in those rural communities. So I thank you for your consideration when you get to work session. I'd appreciate it if you would see your way through to moving this, and I promise we will concur on the House side.
Is your committee still open?
Yes, we are.
Oh.
Thank you, Representative Shetterly. Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative, what you're trying to do is to get Dallas included within the Type B hospital district?
Dallas is a Type B hospital, but it is, Mr. Chair, Representative Vire, Valley Community in Dallas is a Type B hospital, but because of, if you look in current law, it's in the italics on lines 13 to 18 of the dash ones, we are a Type B hospital, but we are within 30 highway miles of Salem Hospital.
And in so, the major population.
In the major metro, we are in the Salem SMA,
yeah.
And within 30 miles of Salem Hospital. But I'll tell you.
Oh, I see. So it's the or.
Right. Right. We are excluding then hospitals within a county, a different county of a population of 75,000 or less. That's what brings Dallas within the exception of this amendment.
It's the or that's important.
Right.
Understood.
Okay.
Thanks.
Any thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Chevrolet, thank you.
Thank you. It's always good to see you.
It's the room.
It's the room.
Ambiance.
Orient.
Are you kidding me?
Huh. What is that, man? Let's go ahead and orient to the rest of the bill and then talk about the other amendments to 2206.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2206, the base bill, clarifies language to conform with Measure 50 changes in valuation in the ratio study and taxable correction statutes, and clarifies that operating taxes, not the levy, shall be extended on the tax roll and reduced by timber offsets each year. You can tell that this is not my area directly. It replaces outdated language, full true value, with real market value in statutes pertaining to real and personal property of the United States, which is subject of a contract of sale, and replaces full assessed value with real market value for statutes pertaining to real and personal property of the United States held under lease. And stipulates that the changed property ratio shall not exceed one. So basically it clarifies some statutory language and conforms it to the needs of constitutional language of Measure 50.
Thanks, Ed. Now, what do the subsequent amendments do? We've heard about 2206-1.
Correct, Mr. Chair. You've heard the dash one amendments. That's an income tax credit issue. You also should have dash two, dash three, and dash four amendments. Actually, I've been informed that the dash four amendments supersede the dash three, so we probably won't be considering the dash three. But what they do, what they represent are options for conforming Oregon statutes with the gist of a tax court decision regarding the tax treatment of like-kind exchange property under Internal Revenue Code Section 1031. This is a fairly recent opinion that has come out and requires some attention.
Mm-hmm. Can we have forward the folks who have drafted the dash two amendments and would like to have those discussed? Yes, that's the dash two, there's dash three, dash four. We're currently considering the dash two amendment.
Chairman, can I bring two folks up with me?
Please do.
As long as they speak English.
Sure, put all those requirements in.
Good morning. Mr. DiLorenzo, are you here to present the dash two amendments?
The dash three amendments, Mr. Chairman, but I can also comment on the twos and the fours.
Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is John DiLorenzo. I'm here on behalf of my client, Harsh Investment Corporation. With me today, to my right, is Mr. Greg Baum, who is Vice President and General Counsel for Harsh Investment. And to my left is Mr. Ted Malaska, who is Vice President and Director of Taxation for Harsh Investment. And they are here to answer any questions you may have following my brief presentation. We're distributing a couple booklets to you right now, and those contain some TAB materials that you may or may not wish to reference during the course of our presentation. Harsh Investment is a major Oregon investor in real estate operating in Oregon and in all of the western states. The company and its business is sensitive to developments in the tax code, since these must be taken into account and influence every transaction the company engages in. But in addition to its investment activity, Harsh is also known for its philanthropy in our state. Under the stewardship of Earl Darlene and Jordan Schnitzer, the company has established an enviable record of private support for charitable causes in Oregon. The hand interlineated amendments, which are at tab 3 of the materials I am having distributed to you, conform now to the dash 3 amendments that that you have, and I've given them to your committee assistant, who I think I see is distributing them now. They conform directly to the dash 3 amendments that you have before you. For quite some time, the dash 3 amendments are designed to address a very abrupt change to Oregon's tax structure, which occurred by way of a judicial order this last February. And that is the decision which your committee revenue staff administrator referenced earlier in his presentation. For some time, the Internal Revenue Code in Section 1031 has permitted owners of like-kind properties to exchange those properties without recognizing gain under the federal tax code. Generally, whenever whatever investment basis one has in property that is to be exchanged continues into the exchanged property. Only when the property is finally sold or otherwise disposed of is gain recognized and tax paid under the federal system. And generally, unless otherwise provided, the Oregon tax code follows the federal code. Oregon has for quite some time permitted the deferral of gain for Oregon income tax purposes when the exchanged property and the newly acquired property were both located in Oregon. In 1991, the legislature amended ORS 314.290 to allow residents in Oregon who exchanged property for property located outside of Oregon to still receive the benefits of the deferral. That was the change that the 1991 legislature made. And that change was made at Section 16A of House Bill 2164 in 1991, which is appended to your materials at tab 4. I apologize for my typographical error in my testimony. It says 16B. It was Section 16A. The bill was designed to reconnect in 1991 Oregon's tax code to the federal code and was in response to a number of federal acts which were passed by the Congress. The current version of the law, 314.290, is appended to your materials at tab 5. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the 91 change allowed Oregon residents who exchanged property for property located outside of Oregon to defer their gain unless and until they became non-residents or unless and until the property was ultimately sold or otherwise disposed of. Non-residents, however, under that 91 change, still could not take advantage of that rule where they exchanged property for property located outside of Oregon. This rule, which permitted Oregon residents to defer gain with respect to property exchanged for property outside of Oregon, has, however, been effectively repealed by the Oregon Tax Court in McLean versus Department of Revenue. That case, which was decided in February of this year, is appended to your materials at tab 6, should you care to review it. In 1995, the plaintiffs in McLean, who were residents of Colorado, exchanged Oregon investment property for Colorado investment property. Because the transaction involved a like-kind exchange, they qualified for deferral of the recognition of their gain under the federal tax code. But because the plaintiffs were residents of Colorado at the time of the exchange, and they had exchanged property for property located outside of Oregon, the Oregon Department of Revenue denied their request for a deferral under the provisions of 314.290. The plaintiffs alleged that they were being treated differently from Oregon residents, and that this disparate treatment violated a number of provisions of the United States Constitution, including the Privileges and Immunities Clause of the Constitution. In analyzing the case, the tax court noted that the Oregon legislature intended in 1991 to make more widely available the benefit of gain deferral for residents of Oregon. However, at page 11 of the decision, the court recognized that in doing so, the legislature created a discrepancy in treatment based solely upon residency. The court concluded that this disparate treatment between residents and non-residents violated the Privileges and Immunities Clause. Although my client and many residents of Oregon would likely sympathize with the decision up to that point, we take great exception to the remedy which was then imposed by the tax court. Instead of permitting the non-residents to enjoy the same privileges that the residents enjoyed under the Oregon Tax Code, the Magistrate Division of the Tax Court opted to sever away the 1991 changes that were made to thereby create equal treatment. In other words, because the court ruled that this unequal treatment could not be tolerated, the court opted to prevent Oregon residents from being able to take advantage of the 1991 change by the legislature. At page 14 of the decision, the court issued sort of an invitation. The court said, quote, while the legislature in 1991 intended to expand the availability of like-kind exchange deferral, the court does not have the power to add provisions to the statute enabling non-residents to reinvest outside Oregon to elect deferral and file information returns. If it so chooses, the legislature may amend the statute in order to further expand the availability of gain recognition deferral according to the constitutional provisions discussed above. The court thus declares ORS 314-290-2B severed from the Oregon revised statutes because it unconstitutionally creates disparate treatment for residents and non-residents of Oregon. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we are asking the committee to respond favorably to the court's invitation to so amend the statute. The elimination of this benefit, which was created in 1991 for Oregon residents, will have dramatic consequences in our view. First, the elimination of the 91 benefit will discourage any real estate investor located either inside or outside of the state to reinvest in Oregon properties. In order to qualify for 1031 treatment under the federal tax code, an owner contemplating an exchange must identify like-kind property within a 45-day window and must close a transaction within a 180 window. Those are very severe restrictions. For large investors, there may not be sufficient like-kind properties available for exchange located within the state of Oregon. Those large properties may be located in other states. If an Oregon resident investor is not permitted to look to properties outside of the state of Oregon as exchange candidates, that investor will be less likely to invest in Oregon properties to begin with. In addition, investors located outside the state of Oregon will be discouraged from investing in Oregon properties located inside of Oregon. Several of my colleagues who practice real estate law have already told me that Oregon lawyers are fielding calls from lawyers, accountants, and real estate brokers from other states questioning whether their out-of-state clients should continue to look for exchange opportunities inside of Oregon because of this tax court decision. In addition to the consequences attendant in this decision in the real estate area, they are even more severe in a non-real estate context. As you know, 1031 not only pertains to like-kind real estate exchanged, but also to like-kind non-real estate capital assets. An Oregon investor would be less incentivized to purchase non-real estate capital assets, such as radio stations, paper mills, sawmills, and the like, without knowing that the property could be exchanged for like-kind property located outside of Oregon. To identify these kinds of capital assets, one must search on a regional basis, as opposed to confining the search to the state of Oregon. The fact that there is not an abundance of this kind of property will, in our opinion, impair the large property real estate market and the non-real estate capital asset market if the legislature fails to respond to the court's invitation. At a time when Oregon's economy is under great pressures, it would be improvident, in our view, to further depress our markets by permitting this benefit for Oregon residents to vanish. In addition to Harsh Investment Corporation, there is a host of organizations, some of whom are appearing today, urging your adoption of the Dash 3s as a response to the tax court amendments. These include the Building and Owners Managers Association, the National Association of Industrial and Office Properties, Tycor Title Company, the Commercial Association of Realtors of Oregon and Southwest Washington, the Oregon Association of Realtors, and a variety of exchange facilitators and many others. Chairman, members of the committee, we urge your favorable consideration of the amendments and are available to questions. I will conclude also by saying, by talking very briefly about the difference between the amendments. It is my understanding that the Dash 2 amendments treat in-state taxpayers and out-of-state taxpayers the same, only they deprive those taxpayers of the 1991 opportunity. The -3 amendments grant to in-state and out-of-state taxpayers, residents, the advantages of deferral. And the -4s appear to be very similar to the -3s with one exception, with two exceptions, and they're parallel on pages 2 and on pages 3 of the -4s. There is an additional provision with respect to record keeping. In both the 3s and the 4s, the Oregon Department of Revenue is authorized to require taxpayers who have acquired these properties and who are out-of-state residents to keep in touch with the Department of Revenue so that the department can track when, in fact, those properties are ultimately sold. The -4s include something that I am not very enthusiastic about, which provides that if the taxpayer fails to file that particular annual report, there is a presumption that the property was sold. My own view is that this will probably create more harm than good, because there will be many taxpayers who, for want of filing the right paperwork, will unwittingly trigger some fairly significant tax impacts. But other than that, the threes and fours appear to be the same. With that, I will conclude. I appreciate the patience of the committee, and we are available to answer any questions you may have.
Questions from the committee? Mr. Vice Chair?
Mr. DiLorenzo, can you point to that last comment that you made? Where is that in the -4s?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, in the -4s, they appear at page 2, lines 13 through 16, and at page 3, lines 17 through 20. I conducted a fairly cursory review, but I think that's the only difference between the two versions.
So the amendment that you brought before us, the -3, preserves the like-for-like provisions on exchanges, but it regionalizes that.
Mr. Chairman, it makes it available for both in-state and out-of-state residents.
So regionalize it to the,
entire country, states. All 50 states.
And does the provision depend on states which are, have a state tax code that are connected to the federal code, or does it matter?
Mr. Chairman, it is my understanding that it doesn't matter.
Sorry. On the -4 amendments, the additional record keeping clearly is meant to put the burden of proof for the continuation of the tax benefits on the holder of the benefits by requiring that an annual filing be made. The absence of the filing would create the conclusion that the property has been sold. Is that a rebuttable conclusion? Is that something that the taxpayer can argue favorably in an administrative procedure, or does the is the ruling of the administrative procedure a final ruling?
Mr. Chairman, I understand from just my review of the text that it is a rebuttable presumption, so that suggests that the taxpayer could challenge the presumption.
Okay. I'm sure the Department of Revenue has some opinion on the -4 amendments. We'll seek that in a bit. Any further questions for the panel, Senator Corfin?
Yes, Mr. DiLorenzo, thank you for bringing a new word, hand interlineated. And in the -3, I just was curious what the addition of section 10, the reference to 1033 and the difference between voluntary or involuntary, some example of that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Corcoran, I'm going to yield to legal counsel for the company. I have a cursory understanding of it, but I want to make sure you get the exactly right. Let's go to our director of taxation.
Is your cursory understanding defined by clients who followed your advice in tax matters?
I thought it was in reference to an Italian explaining something to an Irishman.
I will preface it by saying I believe 1033 applies to involuntary exchanges, but I'll yield to
that's
to
exactly the right. It's involuntary in the form of fire condemnation by municipalities or other governmental bodies. Fire, shipwreck, those kind of things. Insurance covered usually, but oftentimes condemnation in nature. So it's a parallel deferral to 1031 in more limited situations when exchange is indirectly inferred by the transaction.
Okay. Your question, Senator?
Yep.
Other questions for the panel? And it's and obviously you prefer the dash threes. Is it just because of the record-keeping burden that's placed on the landowner?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. That is actually the landowner or the taxpayer has record-keeping responsibilities under both the dash three and the dash four. The only difference is this rebuttable presumption for failure to file.
Okay.
And so you're correct. Our preference is the dash three.
Okay. Thank you. Others have signed up to testify. I'd like to bring up Mr. Phillips of the Department of Revenue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. The department brought this bill just to address some conforming requests regarding value offsets, changes, problems in the statute that we've noticed since Measure 50 passed that keep surfacing as the years go by. And that's the basic purpose of the bill, other than to offer amendments to people in May that find a good relating clause. So that's I'm happy to answer any questions about the bill itself. But
have you reviewed the amendment?
I haven't, but Deborah has.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue, and I'm the Personal Income Tax and Business Division Coordinator, so the amendments are under my purview, and I have reviewed them, Mr. Chair.
Do you care to comment on the amendment?
The Dash 2 amendment simply conforms the statute to the court decision by repealing conflicting language, so that would give us the status quo that we have now. Residents and non-residents would both be prohibited from deferring into out-of-state property. The Dash 3 amendments do allow deferral into out-of-state property for residents and non-residents. It does, however, have a provision that would allow Oregon to eventually tax gain that accrued while the person was a resident. As an example, if you have a person with a basis in property of $50,000, they exchange that for Washington property when it's worth $150,000. There's a $100,000 gain component that could eventually be taxed by Oregon 10 or 20 years down the road when they have a final taxable transaction. The Dash 3 amendment would allow that gain to be taxed. And as Mr. DiLorenzo pointed out, the difference between the Dash 3 and the Dash 4 is in the rebuttable presumption. The Dash 3 amendment does require that the taxpayer report to us each year under rules that we would provide to show that they still have the property, they have not finally disposed of it, there hasn't been a taxable transaction. The Dash 4 amendment allows us to assume that if they don't report to us, there has been a taxable transaction. In practice, what we would do is if we did not get that form, we would communicate with the taxpayer, ask them, did you forget to file something? Do you have tax that's owed to Oregon? Under current law with other taxpayers in a failure to file situation, we send out up to 3 letters asking them to file a return with us and report the information. So it wouldn't be a matter of immediately assessing tax if that report is a day late. It simply gives us an opportunity to ask them for the information, and if they refuse to respond, then we can assume that they have a taxable transaction.
Ms. Buchanan, over what period of time would that correspondence be generated, and at what point in time does the department make the decision to assess tax?
Mr. Chair, under existing law, with a failure to file just an ordinary income tax return, it can be a year or more before we determine that a taxpayer should have filed a return with us. We send out a letter asking them to file. It's at least 30 days that they're given to respond. It's very often more like 45 or 60 days before we send out a second letter, and then a similar period of time. So it can be several months, perhaps up to 6 months from the initial correspondence to where we finally say we haven't heard from you, and under the law, we're required to determine your tax.
If the tax determination is made
and then the assessment is ordered by the department and forwarded to the taxpayer. How difficult would it be for the taxpayer to, at that point in time, provide information that rebuts the assessment?
Mr. Chair, they would simply have to send us a letter that says, we object to the determination that you made. We don't owe you the tax.
So it wouldn't be subject to an administrative hearing or?
That letter is called a written objection, and that is spelled out in the law as to how they do that. But it is as simple as sending a letter saying, I disagree with what you did. And we would treat that as an appeal to us and go through the proper steps to consider that appeal. They also have the option of going to the magistrate division at the tax court if they disagree with us.
I guess it's my impression that you'd favor the dash course.
Mr. Chair, only because it does give us some authority to compel the behavior that's specified by this language. The Dash 3 does say that they need to file with us each year, but it doesn't really say what are the consequences of not filing that return with us.
Question? Mr. Vice Chair?
Yeah, but it sounds like under either the 3 or 4, you would probably follow the same procedure.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I believe you're correct. We probably would follow the same procedure. It's just that in the Dash 4, it's clearly spelled out that we have the ability to treat that failure to file as a rebuttable presumption that they disposed of the property.
So your authority is clear there, but my sense is under either of them, under the 3A, it says the Department may adopt rules to implement these reporting requirements. So I probably would adopt rules that spell that out anyway.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, there would be some rules, yes. I'm sure that's true.
End in the same place.
There will be some.
I think we end at the same place, regardless.
Do you care to comment on any of the other amendments? The 2 is confirmation. The 3 allows the deferral for residents and for non-residents, which could result in a taxable event. And 4 is simply the reporting requirement spelled out in the. Any other comments?
Mr. Chair, I would just make the comment that there you don't have an amendment here that is another option if you want to consider it, and that would be simply to repeal ORS 314-290 altogether. The result of that would be we would tie to the federal deferral provisions, and if a taxpayer defers into out-of-state property, they defer that gain. If they then move out-of-state and sell the property, that gain would not be taxed by Oregon. So that is another option that does not have an amendment. That is the treatment that we currently provide to gain that has been deferred into a principal residence. So under the old IRC 1034 provisions, if you sold your home and continued to sell your home and you had gain built up, you deferred that into your new home, et cetera. If all of that was taking place as a non-resident, and then you moved to Oregon and you did the same thing and then you moved out, the gain that accrued as a resident was not taxed by Oregon, is not taxed by Oregon. Repealing ORS 314-290 would put this property on the same footing. However, the gain that builds up while they're an Oregon resident would never be taxed by Oregon. That is another policy choice for you, though.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions from the committee? Thanks, ma'am.
Thank you.
We have Mr. Retopped from Stoll Reeves. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Henry Breithaupt. I'm from the Stoll Reeves Law Firm in Portland, and I was privileged to represent the taxpayer in the case that brings these amendments, the Dash 2, 3, and 4 amendments to you today. Let me just say that although my name is German and Mr. DiLorenzo's is Italian, this is not any form of axis operation, but rather...
Senator Beyer, we can hear that.
Both of us could be offended by that.
in the course of this litigation, I think that the tax court magistrate had an opportunity to reach out and, in effect, rewrite a statute. And with all due respect to Mr. DiLorenzo, I think the magistrate correctly refrained from doing that. Saw his job as interpreting the law, not writing it. But as Mr. DiLorenzo has pointed out, clearly also said, it's not clear what the legislature would have done in 91 if it had known that what it was doing was defective. That is, would it have given the benefit of exchangeability, tax-free exchange, or tax-deferred exchange to everyone, resident or non-resident, or would it have said no one gets tax-deferred exchange? I can tell you, because I am one of the people that Mr. DiLorenzo referred to, I have received calls from tax counsel to non-residents inquiring as to what the Oregon rule is. And when they hear what the rule has been and what it might be, they almost immediately indicate that they will explain to their clients that under no circumstances should they consider exchanging into Oregon real estate. I believe personally that that's a bad result for the Oregon markets, both the real estate markets and, as Mr. DiLorenzo pointed out, the exchangeability of other assets, business assets. So I think that, and I can tell you that from the point of view of the taxpayers in the case that led to this, they would be perfectly happy and believe it quite appropriate that the Dash 3 or Dash 4 amendments be adopted to basically provide the 1991 benefits the legislature was focusing on, Oregonians and non-Oregonians alike. In the litigation, the Department of Revenue's objection, or the Department of Revenue's defense, really, of the rule that existed, that is, that non-residents would get taxed, was really based on an assertion that really almost had to be done because otherwise we'd never be able to find them, track them, keep track of them, ultimately collect the tax that was due. I think the Dash 3 and Dash 4 amendments really answer that objection by providing that the department has the authority to require reporting, require information so that tracking can be done. So the major objection which the litigation position of the department put forth has been answered in the Dash 3 and Dash 4, and I would urge that one of the two of them be adopted. As between the two, I think there's been a full discussion of whether the rebuttable presumption exists or not, but I think both of them solve the problem in a very good way.
And it's the differential treatment of taxpayers that proved to be fatal in the previous consideration.
Yes, not just that it's differential treatment, but that the difference was depended upon where you were a citizen. If you were a citizen of Colorado, you got one treatment. A citizen of Oregon, you got another. And from the time of really prior to the Constitution of 1787, all the way back to the Articles of Confederation, the founding writers for this country said, we're going to have one economy, and you should be able to travel between the states and invest and do all kinds of things without having discrimination based on your home state, where your home state is. And this decision really says you can't limit these benefits to Oregonians. What this legislation does is say these benefits should now be available to Oregonians and non-Oregonians alike, the Dash 3 and Dash 4.
Thank you, Mr. Brightapp. I especially appreciate your commentary on judicial restraint. We see it so seldom. Questions? The additional testimony from Janet Jarvis, please.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Janet Jarvis, and I'm here today on behalf of the Commercial Association of Realtors. I don't have a great deal to add to the testimony that you've already heard in terms of the technical particulars of the Dash 3 amendments, but would like to encourage you to accept the Dash 3s. The Commercial Association of Realtors is interested in being able to keep investment opportunities in Oregon a viable option for both Oregon residents and non-residents. And when you consider that the total number of properties available in Oregon are actually limited relative to other markets, to not approve these amendments could conceivably discourage, and I think you've heard testimony to the fact that it could very much discourage investment here in Oregon. And for that reason, we'd like to have you encourage you to accept the Dash 3 amendments. Do you have any questions?
Questions for Ms. Jarvis? Senator George.
Just a curiosity question. You mentioned limited supply. Is that because so much of the state is owned by government, or what would be the reason for that? Or is it just,
well, just relative
industry?
Just relative to the amount of development in Oregon with respect to other states.
Right.
six counties are considered urbanized.
Yeah.
36 are not. Yeah.
Any questions of the committee about the organization of the bill or the options before us? I see that we are encouraged to adopt dash one because of the relating clause of this bill, and probably for no other reason that they can be civil. And then dash three appears to have all of the prescriptions that it needs, assuming that rules will be written by the administrative section of the Department of Revenue, that probably will look a great deal like the dash four amendments, if I was following the vice chair's logic in his question. I'm prepared to go to work session on this bill. Let's open the work session on House Bill 2206. We'll entertain motions. Mr. Vice Chair.
I would move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2206.
Dash one amendments have been moved by the Vice Chair. Are there any questions to the motion? Any objections to the dash one amendments?
That is going to be combined with?
Yes, sir. Okay. No objections, so ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Vice Chair.
The next one, I guess I'll pose it as a question. I suspect that the dash four, dash three are about the same. We're going to end up with the dash fours anyplace. My inclination would be to move the dash fours because they're more specific, but I don't know if the committee would prefer the threes. I'll move the threes.
Make your motion if you wish.
I'll move the dash four amendments to House Bill 2206.
Dash four amendments have been moved on House Bill 2206. Any questions to the motion? Hearing and seeing none, any objections to the motion?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have an objection? State your objection, Senator George. It may be, the argument may be instructed to the committee.
Well, my concern, Mr. Chairman, as we had expressed to us, is that I understand the issue of rebuttable position. I believe that if you, in fact, you have a rulemaking process that would occur under the dash threes, that it might have a better chance of ending up with something that all groups would agree with, rather than what appears to be a slight objection to the dash fours.
Good point. With a rulemaking procedure, you'd have advance notice, opportunity for a broader community participation, hearings possibly connected to the rulemaking. We do that now, but I think this is more cursory a review, I think, than a formal rule adoption.
That's my thought exactly.
Anyone that?
Move the threes.
Mr. Chair, I will withdraw the fours and move the threes with the assumption, again, that we'll end in the same place. My assumption for the record is that the department will exercise through the rule of rebuttable presumption, and that's perfectly fine with the legislature.
Okay. The dash four amendments are withdrawn by the maker of the motion, and the maker of the motion also moves the dash three amendments with the caveat that he expects rulemaking to put into effect a rebuttable conclusion, a rebuttable assumption, so that the department has full capability of notification in connection with that remedial process. Any questions on that motion? Hearing none, any objections to that motion? So ordered. Mr. Vice Chair?
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2206 as amended to the floor with the repass.
House Bill 2206 as amended is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Does everybody understand the motion? Any questions? Objections to the motion? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Boy, we need a carrier who understands tax policy for this one.
Yeah.
Mr. Vice Chair, would you do the honors to carry the bill? Thank you. And we're finished with the House Bill 2206. Shall we move on to House Bill 2208, please? Thanks, Ed.
Who's that?
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you today?
Good.
Good.
She brought her calculator, Mr. Chair.
Uh-oh.
<I'll check it>
Uh-oh.
Mr. Mr. Chairman and committee members, this is the first time you've heard 2208, and it passed the House Revenue Committee, and it was brought to us by the Department of Revenue, and it has several things added to it from its original form. I think I'll just start by going through the different sections of the bill, just to make it clear that where everything is in the bill. To begin with, Section 1 is going through and removing some obsolete language pertaining to what needs to be written and noted on the tax roll. Section 2 is then just changing a few words, such to the. Section 3 goes through and refers to where to place Section 4, and Section 4 is one of the major changes the Department of Revenue brought forward, which is dealing with the local option, and it's specifying the requirements for a local government if a local option tax is approved in the September election, and the district then wants to impose that levy in the current year. So this is just due to some situations that the Department of Revenue has seen for local taxing districts and making it clearer when they can actually use local option levies that have been approved in the September election. In Section 5, it's then requiring to further clarify that the district that does have that local option levy approved has to submit a supplemental budget if the district wants to use those revenues in the current year. It applies to tax years beginning 2002-03. Sections 9 through 12, just are some language changes. There's nothing substantial in there. Then sections 11 through 19, this is another, these are sections that were brought forth by the Department of Revenue in dealing with ag processing statutes. And when we had the Ag Processing Interim Work Group, they also looked at just reorganizing some of those statutes without making substantial changes. And so that's what those sections are doing, is just reorganizing it but not changing the meanings of the statutes at all. So that all applies July 1st of 2002. Then in Section 20, we brought forward the Department of Revenue again, and we had testimony from Elizabeth Harchenko on the House side dealing with the Elderly Rental Assistance Program and the nonprofit homes for the elderly. And these are just allowing a few changes to those programs that will make it easier for the Department of Revenue to forecast how much money they're going to need for their payments of those programs. So it allows the Department of Revenue to divide their appropriation. Right now their appropriation is together for the Elderly Rental Assistance Program and the nonprofit homes for the elderly. So it allows the Department of Revenue to divide this appropriation for the biennium between the 2 years based on the department's best estimate of how much they're going to need for each program, and then allow proration of the program payments to both programs, not only the Elderly Rental Assistance Program, which is the only one that's prorated now, but also allow nonprofit homes for the elderly to also be prorated. And then in Section 21, that shows that these changes are going to take place 2001-02. And then in Section 22, what we're also doing along those same lines to make it easier for the Department of Revenue to forecast their program payments is to move up the late filing deadline for the nonprofit housing corporations to September 15th from December 31st, which is current law, in order to better predict those program payments that they're needed for the nonprofit housing for the elderly. Then with Section 23, it's going through allowing that proration of nonprofit homes for the elderly. Section 24 applies, says that all these changes apply beginning 2001-02. Section 25 then is going through, and this is the section that we talked about some in the bills we had in the past dealing with the senior deferral program. So Section 25 is dealing with the maximum household income limit that is currently in law for the senior and disabled program. So Representative Witt had a constituent who had over the income limit of $27,500. And so in order to accommodate that for future years, this is going to allow seniors and disabled individuals who want their property taxes deferred to have the income limit to come on the program be at $32,000. And that begins 2003. And then in Section 27 is a disclosure issue for the senior and disabled program, and it just allows the Department of Revenue to transmit these property tax deferral amounts to the county without liability for disclosure issues. It applies to the deferral in tax years beginning 2001-02. And then finally, in Section 29, is the extension on the sunset. It extends the sunset for the tribal land under application to be placed in U.S. trust with the federal government. It extends out that program 10 years to July 1st, 2012. So now to go through, we also have an A-10 amendment before you today. And what that A-10 does is this is going to be, as we were talking about, Section 25 goes through and increases that maximum household income limit for the senior deferral program from $27,532. This is trying to link then that program, the senior deferral program, to the special assessment deferral program. And the special assessment deferral program is for local improvement districts and cities that have local improvement districts formed for their taxpayers, and they assess a special assessment for maybe a new water system or sewer system. Then they would have a special assessment, and then some of those seniors who also could qualify for the deferral program could have their these special assessments deferred. So that's what this amendment is doing, is it's increasing the household income limit threshold. Currently, right now, in the past, the household income for the special assessments was consistent with the senior deferral program, but it has gotten out of sync. And so now that in current law, the special assessment household income threshold is only $17,500. Okay, so this, and the way the amendment is written is it just increased it up to current law, which is $27,500. And then it also indexes that household income threshold annually to changes in the CPI, which is what we do now with the senior deferral program. But one change that will need to be made to the A-10 amendment is that proponents of this amendment would like to have this special assessment deferral program be consistent with the changes in House Bill 2208. So we're going to need to conceptually amend the A-10 to allow it to not only go up to current law, but up to the $32,000, which is what we're changing right now, the household income limit to under 2208. So just realize there's two places in the A-10 where we need to conceptually amend the $27,500 to $32,000. It's on page 1 and then again on page 3.
Did you want line 24?
Yep. And
3, line
5.
Thank you.
Okay, so when we do that, then these two programs will be consistent. Then a senior, if they're already on the senior deferral program, then they can automatically have those same limits and everything for any special assessments that they may have from local improvement districts. Now, as far as the revenue impact, you've got it's made up of basically three components now, which is extending the sunset for those tribal lands that are under application to be placed in U.S. Trust, and that extension of the sunset is really a minimal reduction in local revenue of $50,000 if the sunset was not extended. And then for the state government, basically looking, the changes we're making is to the senior property tax deferral program, in which when we're going from $27,500 to $32,000, when we're increasing the number of seniors, we're estimating we're increasing by approximately 232 seniors in the 2203, with an average payment of roughly $1,400. This will result in an increase then of additional tax that will need to be deferred of $324,800 in the 2203 and $679,000 in 2305 biennium. And then if you're increasing then as we are with the A-10 amendment, this will not have as big an impact because there are just a few seniors who also would have these LID special assessments. And the Department of Revenue has a little higher estimate than what I have put here in the revenue impact, but I had estimated 36 additional individuals would be participating in the special assessment deferral program with an estimated tax deferral of approximately $18,000 in 2203 or $36,000 in 2305.
Questions on the orientation?
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Elizabeth, on section 11, page 8, is there a revenue impact on the change there, adding livestock, fur-bearing animals, and bees to the exemption from taxation on personal property? Is that accounted for in your revenue impact, or is there much of a revenue impact by doing that?
Senator Castillo, a lot of those changes are all part of that ag processing interim work group, just reorganizing. And so you will find these later in the bill. It's not really like it's a change in current law, it's just reorganizing it.
Okay.
I know it's confusing when you're reading through those sections, because it looks like we're deleting a lot and adding a lot, but it's just really reorganizing.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions? We have two folks that have signed up, or two sets of folks. John Phillips from the Department of Revenue. Would you please come forward? Good morning, again.
Good morning. Thank you. John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. I'd like to address the bill and the parts, sections 4 through 8, if I can. We really brought this bill to address a situation in Oregon where local budget law is an act that's found in the statutes that guides all local governments in Oregon, roughly 1,500 taxing districts, to form their budgets and to publicize their budgets, hold hearings, and finalize their budgets. And the deadline on that process is June 30th. After June 30th, whatever levy authority or revenues that aren't in their budget are strictly limited. The conflict that keeps coming up year after year is that we still have in statute an option to go for a September election opportunity, and where a district can ask for a ballot be placed on the September election and a local option approved, which would give them additional levy authority. But if they've passed the June 30th deadline and have not included that levy in their budget, there's a line drawn in the sand after which they couldn't spend it even if it was approved by the voters. And what it's done is it's placed local governments in some difficult situations where a process, local budget law, that's designed to encourage public input through the whole development and hearings process, and then after June 30th, they get full community support, 50-50. In other words, they have to have double majority turnout. They get public input, and then that process is denied because of this conflict in the law. So what our proposal is that they would be able to expend that money, but only after a supplemental budget. So what they do is they pass their normal budget by June 30th. They then at some point late in June or July or August decide to go for a September election. If they're successful, then they go through a hearings process and then can spend that money. And that was the purpose of this these sections, and that's why we brought it before you. What we've had to do in the past sometimes is review these situations on a circumstance-by-circumstance basis, and have even in some cases issued supervisory orders to allow that expenditure, but rather than to do that on an ad hoc basis, if it's a good policy, then it should be in the law. And I'm available for any questions on the
Thank you.
Who else?
DJ. Welcome to the Revenue Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm B.J. Smith. I'm the Government Relations Director for Clackamas County. I have with me Bob Vroman, who is with the Assessor's Office of Clackamas County. I believe we are the originators of the A-10 amendments that have to do with expanding the opportunity for a low-income senior to defer the local improvement assessment. I'm appearing on behalf of the Clackamas County Commission, and also we have a Water and Environmental Services District, which is a county sewer district. And as you know, the provision of local sewer services or streets or sidewalks is often financed with local improvement assessments. And we noted that in 1977, the senior property tax deferral and the local improvement assessment district came from the same organic law. And the similar income amounts were used for both programs. As we go out in the field and we have public hearings and talk with seniors about local improvement assessments that may be coming their way, occasionally we'll have a senior who will say, I can defer my property taxes, can I also defer my assessments? And we end up talking to them in regards to different income limits, $27,000 deferral limit for local property taxes, but only $17,000 for local improvement assessments. We felt that that really does a disservice to the senior who is in need of some deferral for their work, and we would like the committee to adopt the A-10 amendments and make the income limits, as your staff has indicated to you, make the income limits the same as you adopt for the senior deferral program. And I have Bob here from our assessor's office, and he would give you just a couple of more comments about how successful the senior deferral program has been in our county.
Actually, I think the benefits are well known to the committee members. The other thing is that this is a deferral, and a deferment eventually ends up in revenue. As the deferment ends, the sale of the property or the demise of the beneficiary of the deferral. So it's not that the local revenue is denied to the local taxing district. It is, in fact, deferred to the local taxing district. So, Daniel, do you have any questions, or should we just go to work session and do that? We'll open a work session on House Bill 2208.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Vice Chair.
First, I would make a... two conceptual amendments to the A-10 amendments before us. The first would be on page 1, line 24, changing the $27,500 to $32,000. And then on page 3, line 5, making the same change.
Page 3, line 5, $32,000 from 27.5, page 1, line 24, same change. The Vice Chair has moved a conceptual amendment to the House Bill 228-A10 amendments. Any questions? Any objections? You can see none, so order.
Mr. Chair?
Vice Chair.
Move the A10 amendments as just amended by the conceptual amendment to House Bill 2208.
Motion is to move the A-10 amendments as conceptually amended into House Bill 2208. Any questions on the motion? Objections to the motion? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Vice Chair.
Move House Bill 2208, A and Gross, as amended to the floor with the details.
The motion is to move House Bill 2208, A-10, as amended, A and Gross, to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any questions to the motion? Objections? Hearing and seeing them, so ordered. Any volunteers to carry this good bill to the floor? The chair will carry it. So ordered. We have three other bills before us. Colleagues, House Bill 486 is a bill that I think has generated a great deal of interest, but that's not generated the attendance of the legal counsel that will help us work through the bill. So we're going to defer that until tomorrow's hearing. We'll post that for first thing tomorrow morning. So we have left on our agenda House Bill 2676 and House Bill 2270. So let's work House Bill 2270, please.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, with House Bill 2270A, we've heard this once before, it's done with historic property tax exemption. Now, you had a dash A18, and I think I'll just try to go through that again because I did a revenue impact to that, which will help maybe explain it a little bit better. What this A18 was dealing with was providing residential properties with a second 15-year historic special assessment.
Those revenue impacts were filed under another bill in my packet. So I just want people to know that if they can't find them.
Yeah, they were in my
too. They were in mine as well, and I found mine, so it was like a little Easter egg in there. What were they filed behind again? Like you were behind 2206?
The last one we just did. Yeah.
You accused the heck out of me for about 5 minutes, I'll tell you.
So you should have 18 and you should have a dash 18 and a dash 22 in your package to consider. Yes. Thank you.
And you do have a dash 19 amendment, but I didn't give you a revenue impact for that.
Dash 19, yeah. Thank
okay.
You.
So with the dash A18, which was handed out at the last session by Representative Butler, this is going to give a second 15-year partial property tax exemption for residential historic properties. And these could be condos and things. We have discussions about that. But the way I'm reading this amendment is that they would allow them. It's just amending the bill so that we are going to still be allowing this step up, which is very important because that does have a very big impact on the revenue impact. So at the end of 15 years, the residential historic specially assessed property becomes disqualified, and then it then is reset again, and they begin another 15 years. So that's the way the revenue impact is making that assumption.
Okay, let's, for just the sake of clarity and discussion, it's the A18 that resets the value.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. And it is the current bill that is clarifying that in law, too. That's what the A engrossed bill does, is it clearly says that now you've got, for a second, it's really discussing in the bill commercial properties, because, again, what came out of the House Revenue Committee was just allowing commercial properties to have a second 15-year historic special assessment, and it clarified how those commercial properties would have to be reset then. It would go 15 years, become disqualified, and then they'd be reset up again and to a higher level and then begin another 15-year special assessment. But in this particular case, with Representative Butler's amendment, he is amending that bill, and so I'm assuming there that these residential properties will be reset. Okay, so again with that, if you look on the second page of this revenue impact, I just put a little table there for you, kind of giving you the number, an estimate of the number of taxpayers and the tax amount that would be affected by this extending the residential properties to be allowing another 15 years. So in the, you see that this grows over time. Basically, in the first year, 2002-03, you've got like 139 taxpayers that would be affected by this, and $140,754 in like a tax amount estimate. Now, but what you see is you've got about 450, over 450 residential properties that have already completed one 15-year special assessment. They now are going to have that opportunity in the future to have another 15-year special assessment. So you've got a large base, and then we're seeing currently we have a group of about over 450 different residential properties that are going to be coming off the roll and could also then reapply for another 15-year special assessment. So as you see, and then like over time, again, this is going to grow in the 2003-05 biennium, increases from 139 to 637 taxpayers. And then the revenue impact goes from $140,754 to $829,981. Then in the 2005-07 biennium, you see it increases from 637 to 1,151 to a tax amount of over $1.8 million. So you get the idea that we're building on this, and the reason why that is because each year you're going to have new properties that are going to be eligible then to have a second 15-year special assessment. Mm.
Questions on the orientation? That was the orientation. Dash
A18.
Right. Sure. Mr. Vice Chair.
Elizabeth, is the assumption assumed that all or part of those will go for the second year? Is that a maximum number? I guess you're going to
Mr. Chairman and Senator Beyer, no. What I've assumed is not a maximum. This is, I've assumed here that 40% of the ones that are coming on in a given year would also then want to reapply, and then the ones that are that have already, this base of like 450 that have already been off the program, I'm assuming that 25% of those would go for a second 15 years. And again, as you know, we talked about some in the last hearing, with these residential properties, they will have to fill out another preservation plan, but they're not going to have those seismic expenses and things and that other commercial properties have to fulfill right now for their second 15 years. Okay, so So that's the A18. Yeah. And again, that I've got on there multifamily as well as residential, and the multifamily is really the one that causes more of the bigger revenue impact in the future when a large number of those come off the roll. Okay, then with your A19, just to give you, I haven't done a revenue impact, but what it does, the A19, is it allows new construction to receive historic special assessment if approved by the State Historic Preservation Officer and is used primarily for residential purposes. Or if it's used for non-residential purposes, it's only going to get historic special assessment on the extent to which that square footage of the new construction, when it's added to the total net rentable area of the property, is less than or equal to the total net rentable area prior to the new construction. So basically, you just can't change the total square footage of net rentable area that will receive the special assessment. And this applies in the future, applies only to new construction completed after the effective date of the measure. So that's the A19, and the reason why I don't have any revenue impact on that at this time is just because I thought if there was testimony, they may be able to give us an indication of what particular projects they're foreseeing in the Portland area with that. And then with the dash A22, it allows certain historic properties which have first received a historic special assessment as a commercial property, and this could be like a warehouse or something, and then they are no longer a commercial property, and they will then receive an extension on their special assessment for another 15 years. Now, this is an example in the A22 of where you're not going to have a resetting then of that frozen value at the end of 15 years. This measure is going to allow that frozen value to be frozen for 30 years. It's retaining that same assessed value, that same specially assessed frozen value in the second 15 years as was in the first 15 years. It does have a window, though, in which applications can apply. It applies only to reapplications on or after July 1st, 2002 and before July 1st, 2005. So there are basically five former warehouse properties in Portland which have been converted to condos which would be eligible for this extension on the historic special assessment, which then retains the frozen value for 30 years. And they do, you know, come off the roll and would get this, you know, second 15 year at different times. So in 2002-03, there's only one of those properties that's eligible for reapplication for the second 15 year. Then at that time, local property taxes that would be reduced would be approximately $33,000.